Donalana Kitchen talks about food. Donalana Kitchen talks recipes. Donalana Kitchen talks about lots of other things on Community Radio. Welcome to the Donalana Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We gather here once a week in the studios of KHOI Community Radio in beautiful downtown Ames. We talk about food, farming, advice, recipes, and opinions.
Oh, yeah. We're full of opinions.
We are. Lots of things get talked about around our kitchen table. We get by with a little help from our friends.
Oh, yes. The Donalana Kitchen Show is sponsored in part by Practical Farmers of Iowa, a member-based, farmer-led, nonprofit organization that has been strengthening farms and communities through farmer-led investigations and information sharing since 1985. You can find out more at their website, www.practicalfarmers.org.
Well, it's fall. We've been talking in our Pixmore past shows about fall things and fall flavors and apples. I finally, Aunt Donna, I finally got around to making a decent apple pie.
And you didn't invite me over to try it?
It was a small one. I ate it all. Well,
My husband and I ate it all.
I'll make some more.
Okay.
But
this
was on the advice of Judy Henry from the Bear Patch Farm over by Nevada. She said, there's an apple variety called a macoon. A macoon.
Oh, did you use the macoon?
Of course, Judy's right. The macoons were beautiful.
Yes.
Snow white on the inside, tasty as all get out, and they cook beautifully, but they didn't mush. So it was your ideal apple for an apple pie.
Well, you know, I was reading, I can't even remember where I read this, but they were talking about how you use mostly an apple like that, and then you put a few mushers in so it sauces up as well.
Yeah, actually I did because I had a Honeycrisp sitting there.
Okay.
And I figured, well, there's a big...
Might as well throw that one in. Right?
Of course, yeah. I seldom do anything without...
By the book.
You kind of look at what needs to be used, and there was that Honeycrisp. So, good apple pie, and I always do like my apple pie with a bit of cheese if I have it, so I did.
A Wisconsin girl through and through.
Bet. I always put a little cheese with it.
Cheddar, I suppose.
Well, no, apple. Get this. I had a little sheep's cheese, and it was very kind of a hard, salty sort of strong.
Did you like melt it on top of the pie after?
No,
you
I just kind of crumbled it on. Yeah, good enough.
So in my Illinois childhood, of course, it was you got the choice: cheese or ice cream, right? And the cheese, they would put it in pre-microwave, guys. Of course, you would put the pie slice back in the oven just long enough to melt the cheese on top. It's yum, I have to say. I don't see people doing that much anymore, but it was real common in the 50s, probably. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, isn't fall a nice time? Apples. Apples.
Yes. And finally, we're getting some leaves that are
fallish,
doing the colors that they're supposed to do.
We talk a lot about food here on the Donalana Kitchen, and sometimes we kind of dive into things, and you and I both kind of eat everything that we read labels, and we're kind of careful about eating good things. There's so much to eat, but there's a lot about food that a lot of us don't know, and it's good to have people that know about the whys and wherefores, the how-tos, the what in the world is all this food stuff made of, food science.
So we have with us in the studio today Kate Gilbert. She is a lecturer in food science at ISU. She's also a farm daughter of John and Beverly Gilbert, which is their farm where she, I'm assuming you grew up there, right? South of Iowa Falls. So she's here to tell us a little bit about what goes on in the food science department. Big chemistry experiments, right?
Some chemistry experiments, some microbiology experiments, and a lot to do with food. So... yes, thank you very much for having me today.
Oh, I'm glad you're here. This is wonderful. So, food, it's always been an interest of yours, right?
Yes, definitely. So, like they said, I grew up on a farm, South Iowa Falls.
Dairy farming and hog farming.
Yes.
And I suppose corn and beans.
A century farm, very much a diversified farm. Lots of different pieces that made us crazy or different than the others, but it was how all the other pieces fit together. So, brown Swiss dairy cows.
Oh.
The beautiful brown brown Swiss.
So you grew up with brown Swiss, mm-hmm. and nobody ever changed to Holsteins. Bravo.
No, we had a hired hand here and there that brought some Holstein on the farm, and we allowed them.
I hope there wasn't any genetic mixing in there, right?
There was some for good reasons, but still very much brown Swiss. And my sister-in-law, Sarah, who does much of the milking, we allowed her one Jersey because that's what she grew up with.
Oh, I see. So I grew up sweet. With Guernseys. But, I mean, you hardly see a Guernsey anywhere.
I know.
But.
And then pigs was really the addition kind of in between with some transition. But
your father, John, was the Nyman Ranch Farmer of the Year last year.
Yes, definitely. And we were very fortunate at the time that Nyman moved to Iowa and to expand into pigs. My dad was on the ground floor of that. And that was very advantageous for us because it was a market for how we wanted to raise pigs. It was the quality of pig. It was the type of pig.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the type of company that we wanted to be a part of. So we've been with Nyman for quite some time now, and it doesn't seem like it should be that long, but I think it's been 20 years.
Oh, I'm sure.
And then diversified crops with that. So a lot of pasture for the cows and the pigs, corn and beans, predominantly for feed, but we sell some food-grade soybeans, and then other mixes for silage and that sort of thing for the cows.
Now, the Century Farm, so does that come, like, from your father's father kind of thing?
So great-grandfather on that specific piece of land.
Mm-hmm.
But Gilberts came to Hardin County quite some time ago.
And did your father and mother start out farming with their parents?
So my mom grew up on a farm near Garwin, Iowa. So she had some of that farm background. And then my dad had gone off and they were my dad wrote for newspapers, and my mom was a home ec teacher back when they still called it home ec.
Home ec.
And then they came back late 70s to farm with my grandparents on the farm. So expanded a bit as they added back in.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what I grew up in. And we grew up.
Did your grandparents have the dairy?
Mm-hmm.
So
yep.
I have seen the barn. It's a beautiful old dairy barn.
Yeah. Yes, very, very traditional.
Mm-hmm.
But we were non-traditional in terms of how all the pieces were still in place. And that's a lot what I grew up learning. I didn't understand maybe the hows and whys of everything, but I knew that they all fit together.
Mm-hmm.
And that was an important piece of why we were doing what we were doing. Along with that fitting together was my parents trying to raise three kids through the 80s and the farm crisis.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was gardening. There was a lot of preserving of food. There was a lot of baking at home. And I thought that food all tasted really, really good, but a big piece of it was necessity.
Once upon a time, it was a necessity for absolutely everybody.
Correct. That knowledge was very valuable to save money, to preserve nutrition, to make a lot of things fit together. So I grew up with eggs. I grew up with meat off the farm, milk off the farm,
mm-hmm.
fruits and vegetables quite often off the farm as well. So that's a bit about where my love of food started from. From a very young age, if I could crawl up on a chair and make it to the counter to stir or knead, I was there. And it didn't take me too many more years after that to start asking why.
And you had a grandmother there,
yes.
too, right?
Yes,
right.
So I had a grandmother on the farm, and I had another grandmother down in Garwin, and I baked with both
mm-hmm.
and asked lots of questions all the way through. And some of my traits still come from my grandmothers. My grandma Gilbert was very adamant that if you were going to measure vanilla, you measured it over the bowl, because if you spilled, all that vanilla was going in, which is very much a...
And vanilla is very precious.
Yes.
Yes.
Oklahoma Dust Bowl, Great Depression bringing that my grandmother brought. And
waste not, want not.
Yes. My grandma on my mom's side was just a hoot. You know, she used teacups for her cup measures, but she knew what everything was supposed to look like.
Mm-hmm,
you know, she
mm-hmm.
just had that feel.
Oh,
and she
good.
Was also the one to turn the burner on high to get things started. And I thought that was the greatest when I was younger.
Good.
It's true. It's true.
Cooking with gusto.
Yes. So, I got in trouble when I brought that trait home, but I thought it was a great one at the time.
Put her on. Yes, sirree. So, Farm Girl gets into food science because you asked why.
Yes, very much. So, when it came time to pick a major, I knew I liked science in school. We have a long Iowa State tradition, so I knew I wanted to go to Iowa State. My parents said we could go anywhere, but... Yeah. They would have let me go anywhere, but... growing up on a dairy farm, if you want to see your family, you better figure out if you can make it home. And that was still important for me. Mm-hmm. So luckily I had my oldest brother at Iowa State at the time, and he brought home the course catalog. And I opened it up and I found food science. And I went, what is this?
Simple as that, right?
I love food. I love science. This sounds like a major for me. I had enough questions from the farm upbringing. I wanted to explain why the way we raise livestock and crops dictates quality.
Now, does that mean in your high school, no more home ec or anything like that?
There was still a pretty good home ec program when I was there. And I was very fortunate for that. And I ask students a lot of questions about, you know, what sort of programs you have. But I was most fortunate from my grandparents and my mother. Because once my mom realized that was my creative outlet, she let me go in the kitchen. And it was also helpful.
I bet she did.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. To be able
that much less for her to do.
I have two older brothers and a father who are very busy on the farm. I helped in the farm wherever I could as well, but it took a lot of food. And so as soon as I could help, I was helping to do that. So I wanted to answer a lot of whys and hows, and that's how I chose food science.
Very good. Very good. And so you got a job not originally at – you are at ISU at the part of faculty now.
Yes.
Yes, but you did something a little bit before that.
Right. So as I was finishing my food science degree, I had to ask myself what I was going to do next. And I loved everything I'd learned about food science. I answered so many of the hows and whys.
Can you tell me what some of the courses are like? Like, what are they teaching you now?
Yes. So it's a lot of the basic stuff. So a lot of basic science would be very similar to what animal science or biology or chemistry majors start out with. So chemistry, biology, microbiology, organic chemistry, biochemistry all sits in as your basics. Mm-hmm. And from there, you work into the food department and actually do food chemistry. So what's the makeup of protein and carbohydrates and fats, and why do we care? We talk a lot about food microbiology, so how do we keep food safe, but also fermentation. What's happening? What's those good microbes that are making a bunch of our favorite foods?
It seems we're finding out every day about how complicated our bodies are and all these processes going in. The fermentation thing is just really an interesting thing to think about. Yes, it is.
Yes.
Do you feel like within your... Like now that you're teaching and you had 7 years in industry, going back to where you first started studying it, do you feel like there's a lot of new information incorporated?
No, not necessarily. There's definitely some new things on the nutrition side we're learning.
Well, right, because we're real. I mean, my standard joke is we can send a man to the moon, but there's plenty we don't know about human nutrition. But there's been a lot of inroads in the microbiome. In animals and in humans, in soil, in everything these days.
That research is absolutely interesting in where we're moving, but it takes quite some time for that to be mainstream education. So we're seeing good research on soil microbes. We're seeing good research on digestive microbiome. But our full understanding of the effect of healthy soil or not healthy soil on the food that then moves into nutrition, we have not connected all those dots. So there's hopes, but not connections.
Is anybody in your department looking at this? In the last year, there's been several reports talking about, with the weather changing patterns, that what they are detecting is protein drops in almost all plant matter globally across the planet. Are you guys looking at that stuff yet?
You know, I don't think it's become a research focus in the food science department yet. I see that we need to do more research there. But one of the things that happens in academics a lot is you focus on what's right in front of you. And if you don't fully understand soil microbiology or the way that different crops are grown or the climate change effects on food composition, it's hard to dive in to those pieces and really tie them all together.
So do you find that most of your colleagues in that department, since they probably weren't farm girls and don't have that big picture, they're more narrowly focused?
Yeah, definitely. They just don't have a good feeling what they don't know. And that is so often the case. And that's one of the things that I've had to really figure out, how to put a farm girl and a food scientist together. Because in my head, I thought that those should be very closely related.
I'm with you on that. That's how I landed up in the culinary world.
But, you know, the two streams have gotten further and further apart over time. And so what we would think would be closely connected, looking at a full food system, understanding all of the inputs for that, has really just gotten lost in the melee. And so it's more of a confusing time to be a food scientist and a farm girl than it would have been longer ago.
Well, that's what I wanted to talk to you on the radio, because, of course, my professional culinary career, I was, of course, at liberty, as long as it tasted good and got to the right place at the right time, people didn't mind. But I was like you, curious and curious. And then, of course, having, you know, come from rural farming communities, I had that perspective. So how I look at the food science department and I'm kind of like, ooh, what? So what? And how are you swimming in that pool?
Yeah. So I think we need to back up and put together a few of the pieces, because I've had to kind of stare at this question for a while, really since I left food science as an undergrad and realized what the divide was. I had to figure out a way to make sense of it for myself. And I feel like I've done a pretty good job of that now. And so I think it's important to talk about it. A while back, I was just really trying to put pieces together. But a few things that I think are important to kind of lay the groundwork. The food industry, as I worked out in the industry, have a lot of colleagues there. So the large food companies that are putting food into grocery stores, their goals are to provide what the consumer wants. And that doesn't
That's
always...
That's how they make money.
Right. And they, as long as they can do it at a profit and consumers are happy, that is what food companies will do. But knowing what consumers really want, knowing what to produce, and having consumers fully understand what they want.
Well, and in a business world, you have to anticipate, because if you put something out and the consumers don't like it, that costs you a lot of money.
Yes. You're chasing trends. You're trying to decide what people are going to spend money on. There's a lot of it, a lot of things there. And sometimes there's unintended consequences. And so if you back up and you think about some of the first food products going into the grocery store that were convenience items, so like TV dinners. In the 50s and 60s, TV dinners were great. Families knew how to make food, but they were looking to save some time.
Oh, it was a treat when my sister and I got a TV dinner because first of all, it meant we could watch TV, of which there was not
Isn't
very much anyway.
Isn't that something, how that was connected? But it's true. Mm-hmm. That was a breakthrough. Having something, and again, the science brought it all together to fit in one of those little warm-up
ovens.
Pans.
Yeah. And so that was fantastic. It was a food science marvel, right? It saved people time. It was what consumers wanted. It was safe.
I have to say, it still, as a child, it still took an awful long time to heat that thing up. You know, you're waiting, and it's like 45 minutes plus the time for the oven to warm up. This is pre-microwave, of
right.
course.
So not perfect, but very much a novelty and some nostalgia.
Absolutely.
And so many of the new food products that you look at in the 50s and 60s were just that. They were novelty. They were fun to try. And that convenience wasn't a need. It was a want or nice to have.
That's true.
As time went on, that diverged further, though. So if you think about more women going into the workforce full time, 70s and 80s being more popular, they, of course, had to save more time. It was just the way, you know, they had to figure out how to give some of their time if they were going to go work full time and still make food for their family. So that convenience trend carried on. Mm-hmm. Some knowledge got left beside, you know, the rural if you didn't need it anymore. And so now we've done that one more generation, and we've lost even more knowledge.
Yeah, now people really don't know how to go. I have to say, because I've thought about this a lot, that sort of story about convenience is in some ways, it was another way to push further sales of processed foods. Because the things that people think are convenient, when you look at it, maybe when it comes down to it, didn't save that much time.
Sure.
Some of people, you know, like, how much time does it take to make a stir fry, you know? I mean, really, less time than putting the TV dinner in the oven sort of thing. So I do think that much was made in the PR world, in the food PR world, about convenience. And in a lot of ways, women were told, oh, you don't really want to be in that nasty, dirty kitchen. It's really boring. It's, you know, old-fashioned. It's there was a big commercial push to encourage women not to cook, not to know how to cook, that it was what your grandmother did, you know, and now we're kind of having to counterbalance some of that.
Sure.
But it sold an awful lot of processed foods.
Yes.
And continues to do so.
One of the things I try not to do is point fingers a lot. Because if you're looking at another industry and they were good at figuring out what consumers wanted and they promoted those items, they would be doing their job. But with food companies, it does feel like they've done too good of a job.
Well, yeah, there's that old thing. I think we need to we threw the baby out with the bathwater, as it were, and now we got to work backwards a little bit.
Sure. Yeah. Regardless of how we got here, because I think there are a lot of pieces that got us here. Convenience for many consumers is no longer a nice to have, but it's a necessity. So if you've lost much of your knowledge about how to make food, if you've lost the time and skill to be able to make your own, then you have to have the things that are already made for you or almost already
made
for
you. Well, and you'll see in the culinary, there has been in the last, particularly the last 5 years, a plethora of cookbooks that are saying how to make dinner in 15 minutes for your family and what, you know, kind of what you need to keep in the pantry and trying to instill those basic cooking skills again.
Yes. And there is a love for food. I mean, if you watch Tasty videos or How It's Made videos, there are so many things out on social media that love to think about food. But we now have a very large disconnect. There are a certain amount of consumers that are saying, hey, wait a minute, I have no idea what it is you are putting in those foods, and I want you to tell me or I want you to get them out.
Right, because you still, food in this country has to have a label on the package that lists in order of volume of ingredients what's in there.
Yep, by weight of ingredients in there. But now you can't have a conversation that you maybe could have had years back with a local bakery. Hey, what are those ingredients in my bread? Or with a local butcher. What did you put in my processed sausage? So you've now lost, one, the connection to be able to ask some of those questions easily.
No, you're stuck reading the label.
Yes. And two, some of that background knowledge to know where to start. And so that divide is really dangerous because in media, you get one of two things. Either that new food or new process or new technology is going to kill you, or it's the best thing in the world, don't ask any questions.
Oh.
And that is so frustrating as a food scientist and a farm girl, and where we try to put these two things together, is because the education piece is missing. There's pretty much nothing that is as simple
as... It is so complicated that people, like, can't even be bothered.
Yes. There is, you know, maybe a few poisons out there, but really nothing in the food world is going to kill you. Nothing is the best thing ever.
At least not immediately.
Yeah.
Unless
it's
a pathogen that requires a recall, which
is
completely always unintended.
Yes. So it's always a much more complex conversation. And that's really where I've tried to put the two things together is... Okay, now hold on. We do need to think about the farm aspects, the whole food system here when we're talking about food. We need to talk about educating consumers so we can tie those two things together. And we need to talk about if you want less ingredients in food, there's going to be something else that's going to go away. So,
well, yeah, there's a lot of talk about the clean label. Now, tell me what your take on the clean label means.
The clean label is really what the trend is tied to this confusion. So if you have a bunch of consumers who are asking questions about food and they don't know where to start just because they've lost that background knowledge.
Well, it's also, you know, like if you're buying a loaf of bread, the first ingredient might be wheat and then maybe a little sugar and a little this. And then after that, it's 10 things listed that, you know, did not grow on the farm. Most people don't know what they are. Some of them are just dough conditioners and risers and, you know, stuff like that. But people don't know what it is.
Well, exactly. So their response or kind of knee-jerk reaction is get everything out of the food that I don't know what it is. So,
And I have to say, it's a good idea for people to know what they're eating.
Oh, yeah, most definitely. In any of this, more education is better. Being an active consumer is better. Putting your mouth where your money is. So what you spend money on is what talks. It's what talks
in
the industry.
And don't be discouraged reading the labels. You know, you'll find that once you start reading labels, it's like learning another language. Sooner mm-hmm. or later, you start to see, oh, that's a fairly common thing, and maybe I do understand what that is, and maybe you do then start to look up something that you see that's repeatedly there, and you don't stop reading the labels. Learn. It's just a habit.
We're talking with Kate Gilbert here about really important things, like things we put into our mouth. Yes, we should understand what we are eating. You're listening to KHOI, and this is the Donalana Kitchen. This is Tasty Radio for the heart of Iowa. Back to our kitchen table. We're talking with Kate Gilbert from the ISU Food Science Department over there. There's lots of questions we'd like to ask her. So can you tell me, Kate, we eat all kinds of things. So what is the difference between a loaf of bread that's got all of these long labels and all of these additives plus the kind of bread I might cook at home? What's the difference?
That's a great question. And actually, bread and ice cream are probably some of the best examples to explain things.
Oh, good. Let's talk ice cream,
too. Yeah, we could do both. I just think they're good examples on things you can connect with.
Okay.
And a lot of that has to do with understanding how our food system works currently. So in order for a food company to produce food on a large scale and send it all over the United States, there's a fairly long distribution system.
And some of it goes all over the world, even.
Yes, most definitely. We'll keep it in the United States just to tie the thought process together. But we are shipping food all over the place. We're importing, we're exporting. But there's generally a central location for the plant. Once the food is made, it's been put on a truck. Sometimes it has to sit for a few days to make sure it makes it through all of the quality checks, make sure it's safe before it goes out the door. Some things go out the door without that, and they'll pull it back later if something bad happens. But there can be from when it's made, it has to sit for a bit. Then it goes out the door on a truck. It typically goes to some sort of distribution center. So now it has to be unpacked there.
Right,
and
you got the manufacturer. First you got the farmer, then you got the manufacturer, mm-hmm. then you got the distributor.
Yep.
And this is all at least one distributor before
yes.
it goes to your retailer.
Yes, often multiple. Yeah, we haven't even talked about farm and ingredients. So we're just actually starting where the bread is made. But there's more up front.
Yep.
Multiple distribution centers before it gets to a grocery store or somewhere where a consumer is going to come buy it. It needs to sit there for a little while just to get the consumer time to come into the grocery store and buy that product. And then the consumer expects once they get it home for that food to be good until they have finished eating it. So that line is much longer than I felt like making bread today and I can get it done in 3 to 4 hours. So in order to work in all of that time and make sure you still have a good product at the end, it takes additional ingredients.
That's right. If I made a loaf of bread and it had to go through all of that, I don't think I'd like it very much at the end.
No.
Of it.
Okay. Most likely it'd be moldy by the time it made it there. It'd be fairly dry and stale.
Hard as a rock, probably. Yep.
Yep. Yep. Most likely. Some good recipes at home will last a little extra. But in general, it takes just a while to get there. Bread in particular, they try to have plants spread out enough that they can move that bread pretty quickly. But that's not always the case. So there are a lot of ingredients.
Plus bread, normal sliced bread is usually not frozen.
Right, right. You lose some quality there. They prefer not to do it. It's also a fairly inexpensive food product. We don't expect to pay a lot for bread in the grocery store. So they don't have as many avenues to increase quality by temperature control. And so the less you have to do with that with the distribution system, the more inexpensive it is.
So what kind of things do they put in the bread, Kate?
So those ingredients, if you can walk all the way through a loaf of bread ingredient deck, you are a good food scientist. Ooh. Because those things are fairly complex. Most of them are some of the ones you've listed. So
say some of the things that we wouldn't know. Like mono
and diglycerides, mm-hmm, are emulsifiers. And almost all emulsifiers are set to help water and oil mix. So think salad dressing. We have natural emulsifiers in egg yolk that's going to do that for mayonnaise for us. But there's all sorts of other emulsifiers that we put into baked products. And at the core, they're all mono and diglycerides. So if you want to think about a fat, you just pull off one
of
those.
What is a mono and a diglyceride made out of?
Yes. So if you think about a fatty acid, you can put three fatty acids together to get to a triglyceride. Triglyceride has kind of a bad name because generally it means something's not very good on a blood test when you get it back, right? But in our case, all fats and oils are made up of triglycerides. So if you pull one of those fatty acid chains off, you now have a diglyceride. Mm. If you pull two off, you get a monoglyceride. So that structure is very common to us. It's just a slight change to make something that's going to help water and oil mix.
Does it do to the preservation of the bread?
So it does a number of different things, and there's generally a couple different kinds, which is where this gets pretty complicated. You may see a lecithin on there.
Which is actually a natural product, comes out of soybeans.
Yes. You can get it from sunflower. It's similar to what you find in egg yolk. So very common. That's going to help
and
you get...
And relatively healthy.
It's a fairly normal ingredient, nothing scary
right.
about it.
So if you see lecithin in a food label, don't worry about that one.
Yeah, you're okay. That's going to help you get the bread out of the pan.
Well,
that sounds pretty silly, right? But if you're making
a machine doing it, yeah.
If you're making thousands of loaves at a time, that lecithin is helpful. You can add another compound to mono and diglycerides to help strengthen gluten. So the protein in your flour that gives you the structure for bread, there's an emulsifier that basically strengthens that. So it's a slightly different function than just mixing water and oil, but it helps give you a nice fluffy loaf every time. Mm-hmm. Staling is a big problem. So they often put in an amylase enzyme, and that can show up on the ingredient deck a couple different ways, but that actually counteracts some of the staling. So staling is cooked starch that reverts back to its original structure.
Staling means it tastes stale.
Well, yeah, it dries out. It's not as tender anymore.
Yeah. Huh.
So there's just an enzyme in there breaking down some of that staling that's forming.
And so what would that read on the label?
I think it actually reads as an amylase, but there may be a couple other ways it's termed. It may just say enzyme on it. Mm-hmm. It's a very small amount, but shows up fairly close to the end. Mm-hmm. There's some other things that we would call dough conditioners that are going to be in there just to help keep it very light and also consistent. Artisan or homemade bread, if your loaf is not completely even each time, no big deal. You made it. You don't care.
Right. You want that rustic handmade look, right?
Yes. But rustic handmade on a large scale is not very easy to sell. Consumers that don't know...
Right. You don't want to open up your Wonder Bread and find a large air bubble in the middle of the piece.
Right. You know, if you don't know where your food's coming from, the next best thing is to have it look the same each time. You know, because otherwise you're going to say, what happened to this one compared to this one? So that consistency is very important if you don't have direct contact with consumers. So many of those ingredients are making sure it's consistent each time as well. So you can say, get those ingredients out of my bread, but you're going to get a different product, and it's not necessarily going to last as long.
And a lot of this has to do with moving that bread around.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it does.
Yes.
And the idea of that old saying, just as great as sliced bread, people didn't used to have sliced bread.
No, that was one of the first technological advances, right? That you didn't have to slice your own bread.
Well, or bake it.
Yes. Yeah. And Wonder Bread, I mean, if you look at those old commercials, so much of it was about providing nutrients and providing calories to kids.
Ah.
That was the big deal.
What was it? Wonder Bread builds strong bodies 8 ways or something? That was the advertisement jingle when I was a kid.
Looking back through the history, they're very fascinating. It was not about whole grains. Mm-hmm. It was not about fewer ingredients. It was the vitamins and minerals.
That you've added to
yes.
things. And breakfast cereal, too. It's mm-hmm. like this box of stuff that pretty much tastes like a
cardboard.
Box. But they added things. Oh.
Yes. And a good piece of that, you know, whole grains are so much better for you. The evidence is clear. So why isn't everything just whole grain?
Right.
That also has to do with how long your food product is going to last.
Ah.
And so when you pull out where the vitamins and minerals sit, you generally pull out the oil portion that's going to go bad
right.
on you faster.
The wheat germ, which carries the bulk of the nutrition from the wheat plant, has natural oils in it, which go rancid very quickly.
Yes, the bran does as well. So as soon as you pull out the germ and the bran and you get your regular white flour, you get a much longer shelf life. So it's not that somebody said, oh, let's pull the nutrients out and it'll, you know.
Well, let's take the nutrients that are inherent in the wheat out and we'll just add them back in.
Yes, yes. That was the solution, to provide those same nutrients but get a longer shelf life product.
I have a question. You mentioned ice cream as something that also it has all sorts of stuff added to it. And occasionally, when you make ice cream at home or in other recipes too, you say use pasteurized eggs. How does one pasteurize an egg?
Well, it's easiest to buy the pasteurized egg from the grocery store.
I figured. How
right,
does one pasteurize?
Lana has her own eggs, so she's not going to go buy pasteurized eggs.
Yes, in a water bath as you're stirring. So it's very similar to doing stirred custard.
Oh,
so where you get
you cook it.
Yeah, yeah. So where you get it warm enough that you haven't fully coagulated the egg, but enough that you've killed any possible pathogens.
So it's beaten up and you use it as a liquid.
Yes.
I thought maybe they zapped it with something.
That recipes say that is because they're in commercial eggs, there is salmonella present enough that they now have this warning on eggs.
There's a chance. So if there is salmonella being carried by the chicken, so if they're not sick with it but it's in their environment, it will show up on the shelf. If the chicken is actually sick with salmonella, so it has salmonellosis, then those eggs are going to have to be recalled. So there's always a chance that the outside shell is going to have salmonella on it. And as consumers, we are not that careful about cracking eggs. If you get a little egg on the outside, the inside, you know, wherever the case may be, there's a possibility of salmonella being
also, it'd get on from the outside in. Yeah, I could see that happening. There it goes.
And we are very good as food scientists. If we know a solution to a problem, we will implement it. It doesn't mean we have all the solutions figured out, but that's where much of pasteurization comes from. So if you think about pasteurizing milk, it's not that all milk had pathogens in it, but it was that pasteurizing will prevent those pathogens from people being sick. They knew how to do it. It was a fairly efficient inline process, so we're going to pasteurize all the milk.
And that is a heating process, too?
Yes. Yep.
Very good. Well, that solved a lot of problems for a lot of people.
Yes.
Well, while we're on about pasteurization, we'll talk about homogenization.
Yeah, that's not heating up. What's homogenizing?
Now, there are many milks on the market that are called cream line now, which mm-hmm. means they are not homogenized. But
yes.
The bulk of milk is now pasteurized and homogenized.
Correct. So to be sold in the state of Iowa, especially, it has to be pasteurized. Mm-hmm. And that's a consumer thing then when it comes to homogenization. If you don't have a consumer that understands that cream naturally rises to the top, then they think something's wrong with the milk if they see that cream.
Ooh,
on top.
Why does it have that little blob of butter-like stuff
yeah,
in it?
What yeah, what is that?
What are those lumps in my milk, right?
Yes, and so that's just making the cream globules smaller. That's all that homogenization
process
is.
How do they do it? They force it through some sort of...
It's generally pressurized, but mm-hmm. it's basically making a large oil droplet into a much smaller one, so it stays mixed up.
Oh, my goodness.
I never did understand why the cream didn't just reconfigure itself back after that.
So in order to get the cream to mix, you can think of it as a bubble that's got a little bit of a protein covering on the outside. It's not exactly a protein structure, but it allows that cream to mix in with a water-based
right.
milk.
Because the cream is fat.
Yes. And so it's that same emulsification problem. That's why you get the cream to separate to the top. They don't want to mix, and the cream's lighter. Well, if you break it into smaller globules, now it will stay mixed in better, and it's also coated again. So you're not going to get that re-clumping together.
Coated with?
Those kind of protein, they just stretch them. So that same outer covering that keeps the cream mixed in, they just do it on a smaller scale. So it's basically...
How do they stretch them?
Well, it's just the pressurized process.
Oh, the pressure.
It does it naturally.
Does it?
Mm-hmm.
Huh. Oh, my goodness.
And so, you know, that one is, I think, personal preference. The unfortunate piece of pasteurization and not homogenizing, it means it's much more difficult to get the cream to mix back in with the milk.
Oh, I'll say, when I make homemade ice cream, it's the only time I buy homogenized milk.
Mm-hmm.
Normally I like the cream top, but if I try to make ice cream with non-homogenized milk, it's problematic, to say the least.
Yes.
It'll separate out even in the churning process,
mm-hmm.
which is not pleasant.
Correct. And I'm guilty of drinking raw milk.
I would if I could.
Yes, because... I know the cows, and I know who's milking them.
You know where your milk has been.
You
yes.
could be milking your own cow. Yeah.
Yes. I'm very lucky. I still own part of the dairy herd that I grew up on, and my family is still milking those cows. And so when I make it home, that's where I pull the milk from. And that's how I know it's much easier to get the cream to mix back in before pasteurization. It's just a swirling process before that heat process.
Does that mean you're making your own butter, too?
No, it means I swirl it all in and pour it in my coffee in the morning.
That sounds excellent.
I'm going home with you. Now, so would you say the same thing about your eggs? Like Lana grows her own eggs. You probably have some hens on your family farm, so you'll eat your...
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. But, you know, the food scientist of me still kicks in and says, it's better to have them cooked. You know, it's basically...
Yeah, that's a good
there's
rule.
There's a chance. Yeah.
It's a good rule.
Yeah.
It's a good
I have to say, I eat Lana's chicken's eggs raw.
And you're here to tell
I'm
the
here,
tale.
I'm here, I am, but I trust you and your standards of cleanliness, and I've seen yes. those chickens.
Yes,
they're okay.
Definitely.
This is KHOI, and this is the Donna Lana Kitchen. Support this fine radio station. You can find out more at KHOIFM.org. You can go there and find the Donna Lana Kitchen webpage. We've got archives, we've got recipes, and there's stuff about lots of other good programs here on this station.
Thank you.
Here we are with Kate Gilbert. She is in the food science department at ISU, and she's an Iowa farm girl.
Yes, definitely. So one of the things that I wanted to mention, it's easy to listen to say, okay, the consumers and farms, the consumers and the food companies are
the
far
eaters.
Apart. Yes. So what do we do about it? And I don't have perfect solutions, but I have suggestions that I tend to tell my students at Iowa State and spread whenever I can. And I'm looking for tester groups to give it a try and let me know if it works. But there's a couple key things that I've seen. One, college kids are generally trying to figure out how they're going to feed themselves. They've just left home.
Yeah, everybody's still hungry. Yeah.
Yes. They've just left home, and they have to figure out what it is they're going to do.
And they have incredible food choice at ISU.
Most definitely.
More than they're used to having.
Yes.
So how do they choose properly, healthfully?
You know, I think it takes a lot of trial and error for them. But what I want them to know—
I suppose there's the traditional freshman 15. So if you gain 15 pounds, you go, oh, oops, maybe this isn't working for me.
Yeah, or you had takeout pizza one too many times and you think—
Oh, I'm sick of that.
Maybe I should look for something else. I think it's an evolution, and there's not necessarily a right or wrong way to get there, but I just want them to be actively thinking. So what you spend your money on is what talks, is what I'm always trying to get by to them, and that's from industry experience. I know that many food companies are out there to make food that consumers ask for. So if consumers don't ask for it, it's not getting made. And it's amazing that it doesn't really take that many consumers going into a grocery store to ask for a product before that grocery store will start carrying it.
Yes, that is absolutely true. Absolutely.
So really that money talks. And college students don't have very much of it, so I just try to put that thought in their head for when they do have jobs and money.
And where have you seen sort of the light go on in their brains about it?
It hits at different times. You know, it's just really interesting to cover a bunch of different food topics. And sometimes they hit my head against the wall because I go, what are these college kids eating? How am I supposed to tie these things together? But you do watch the light bulb here or there. So you just have to have a lot of examples for when they go, oh, yeah, my mom used to make that. That was really good. You know, there's just different triggers for everybody that click. Sometimes they say, I understand what you're saying, Ms. Gilbert, but I'm still going to eat Doritos and drink Mountain Dew. And I say, that's great. You just keep on going, and when something wants to change for you, you'll probably change. So the other piece is spend more time with food. There's just never a time where spending a little bit more time making a recipe or making food.
Cooking does help people You cook it, you usually like it.
Yes, you have more control. You understand more about the different things in your food. If you have nutrition considerations, it's easier to work those in. And you get some of that nutrition knowledge. One of the funniest things that I watch happen, in food labs, I often have Kool-Aid for the students. That sounds silly, but it's very inexpensive. And it can get kind of hot in the food labs. And one of my fears is of students passing out. I've had it happen once.
My.
And it's not a fun experience. So I would rather just make sure they're hydrated while they're there and stay safe. But many of them have not made Kool-Aid before. And so when it comes to knowing that it's a packet of Kool-Aid and a cup of sugar, they just about fall over for two quarts.
Oh, right. Why isn't the sugar already in there? You just add water, right?
Well, that's their first question. And then their second question, you see it processing. They go, there's that much sugar in Kool-Aid? Of course there is. You just haven't stopped to think about it.
Right, because you usually don't see that part of it. You buy something in a bottle, and of course it has that much sugar in it.
Yes. And so that maybe is a silly realization, but the more time you spend making food, the more of those, oh, that's what's in my food.
So the kids make the Kool-Aid then.
Yes. Yeah.
Good.
And so just spending time with food wherever you can and making it a social choice. So invite friends over to make food together. And that's something that I think ties a little closer to, I'm at the front end of the millennial generation. The college students are at the kind of the back end of it. That ties together, thinking about doing things socially or together.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then start having conversations about food. This is the one where we get a little more scary, right? To bring up some of the things about farms and what we need to see happen in Iowa. Definitely, it's on people's minds. So let's use that to our advantage and talk about Iowa and food wherever we can. Those conversations are not always popular, but if you are eating good food while you're doing it, it's easier. And a lot of that is because I think many consumers have not tasted good food. And so if you can get them all...
Low expectations there.
Yes. If Oreos are your benchmark, and there's nothing wrong with Oreos, but if Oreos are your benchmark for a good cookie, there is a lot of room to move into that category.
All kinds of new things to try, huh?
That's a very good thing to remember, yes, yes. And it is a very human, social, it's a way we connect.
Yes, so education is a big piece here. So consumers being open to learning more about their food. So not being scared of the ingredient statement, asking questions, coming to farmers market, looking for local food. Local food is such a big one because now you can connect those two pieces that are so far apart. The consumer that wants to know about their food and the food and how it's being made.
Well, now at ISU, because a large part of student life is feeding them, and the food services at ISU are quite extraordinary, and it's a big piece of what goes on there. So does your food service science department interact at all with the ISU food?
We do a little bit on the education side. The logistics are all separated just because it is fairly complex to feed that many college students.
For example, do you take your kids into the kitchens?
Yep. So we have we've got a couple different options within food science. And so we've got a culinary food science that's a little bit closer to the restaurant food service side. So they work in the dining center. We did a food waste event last spring with a lecture series. And so ISU Dining came in to talk about how they reduce food waste and how they're composting.
That was a big deal. That happened under Nancy Lewandowski instituted. She found out from studies that had been done, if you don't give the students a tray, they don't take as much food. Yes. They can always go back and get more if they want to eat more. Mm-hmm. But somehow having a tray meant they just loaded it all up, and a lot of it they didn't eat.
Yes.
And so she instituted trayless dining, for example.
And they have a lot more options in the dining center to be able to pick from for food as well.
Unbelievable. It's like a food court at a major urban mall.
Yes, so a lot of options so they can pick, really, between something that's already made for them to salads they want to assemble and figure out what they want to put on it.
Great.
So there's options, and the dining service has done a good job of knowing their consumer and figuring out how to adapt to what they're asking for.
Great. Thank you for being with us, Kate Gilbert.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Wonderful. We're coming up on Halloween.
There's always something going on
heaven,
here, Names.
And Kate, heaven knows what's in that Halloween candy, but it is just once a year, of course. So I want to mention there is a music event coming up at the library Sunday, October 28th, The Celtic Roots of Halloween. Bye. Nice person here, Barbara Evenson. Storytelling, music, and learning the highlights of the Celtic Roots of Halloween. Barb is a harpist, and I'm sure she will bring her harp.
Well, and Halloween, it's All Hallows Eve. It's when what was it they used to say? When the veils between the worlds are the thinnest. You know, I mean, it's an ancient, probably very pagan bunch of rituals. I mean, all of us getting giddy, eating silly things and tipping over outhouses and wearing funny costumes.
Don't you dare do that, Donna. So, remember, you are what you eat. Well, we are too. So let's try to eat
good eaters.
Things. You are listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen. Thanks to our guest, Kate Gilbert. And thanks to you, our listener. This is community radio. We can't do it without you. Your ears and your goodwill and your donations make this radio station work. We had music today by David Cantini. Go to khofm.org. Stream, download. We have archives. Put us on your device.
You can listen to us in the middle of the night. If you can't go to sleep, you can.
Oh, well put. We get help.
Anytime you want.
There you go. Happy Halloween. I'm Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
Engineering by Evan Taylor. Eat good food and enjoy life.